I'm Hugo Dislett from Farming Circuits. We have got the pleasure of having online Shane Joyce. Shane, are you there, Shane?
Yes, Hugo. Yep.
Shane, you might like to quickly introduce yourself again. I know farmers have seen you on their DVD, but give a very quick rundown of what you do up there.
Yep. So, yeah, I'm Shane Joyce. I'm 64 years old. We've been the last 31 years on a property in central Queensland, southwest of Rockhampton, 250 kilometres. We've sold that last year, and we've moved to a property at Kilkeelan, which is just on the north end of the Sunshine Coast, a 350-acre property that we're actually beginning a rehabilitation process on.
Right, you've been interviewed thank you, Shane. You've been interviewed quite a few times, and I've got to sort of know a little bit about you, and your work did talk in Soils for Life. Now, how would you describe your the way you farm, or the way you did farm on the Theodore property? It is Theodore, isn't it?
Yeah, Theodore. Yeah. Over the years, we've grappled with the concept of what we actually do, and whenever you fill out statistics forms or surveys, you tend to put yourself down as a grazier. I've had a lot of problem with this, and we kind of moved to becoming grass farmers, and I now classify ourselves as farmers of the soil. So building the soil, basis of the soil, because that's where all our production comes from.
One of the
key things in what we did on the property of Theodore was somehow or other, when we first got there, we managed to set ourselves a goal to have our soils in the best possible condition. Now, when you're working with soils that are somewhat degraded, it's kind of like a bit of a far out thing to say you want your soils in best possible condition, and it really had no timeline on it. But it's been a wonderful goal to set, because it's really dictated a lot of our actions over the past 30 odd years.
Shane, I'll just interrupt there. Shane, how did you set that goal? What had you inspired you to set the goal? Because not many farmers actually identified that particular thing that you identified.
Well, it was a thing that when we moved back to Theodore, I'd spent the last 8 years working on the Sunshine Coast on a property and being a member of a permaculture group. And a lot of the stuff I was coming across was based on rebuilding the soil and the health of the soil. So we came back to Theodore, and the landscape there was plagued by these problems of pasture degradation, soil erosion. They were still trying to find the ideal pasture species, the ideal mechanical intervention, and all sorts of things that were going to fix the problem. So the background in permaculture and reading the likes of Yeomans and Fukuoka kind of led us to saying, well, we need to be looking at the soil and what we can do to fix the soil.
Right. You are lucky, pushing so lucky, that just was fortunate that you were in a permaculture group where you did appreciate the soil, because quite a few farmers will put out synthetic fertiliser, especially the cropping farmers, and they just do it year after year, and although they appreciate the soil, they don't appreciate the soil to the way you do. So can you just keep talking about the soil, because that is... I've been reading some books on, the new way of farming, and both books talk about how farmers have really got to concentrate on getting the soil life going. So could you just expand a bit about that on what's happened to your place with the soil and what's been the benefits of that?
Yeah, Hugo, we were fortunate that I was as a child, I lived in this landscape and watched all the timber being cleared off it. And the brigalow and vine scrub soils were, you know, we were basically told that they had this massive fertility and we could farm forever and never have to add anything to the soils. And so when we arrived back there, you know, 25 years after the clearing was done, it was obvious that the soils had degraded and they were out looking for answers on how to fix it. So we were very fortunate that the property we were on had, it still had quite an area of remnant scrub, and it had been cleared between 1958 and 1965, and so I'd seen the lush growth and the production that came off the land when it was first cleared. I saw it in the state it was in when we got back there, having been away for 10 years or better. And I could see that there was quite a difference. And I think that when you live in a landscape, you don't see those changes so much. It's kind of like living in a house and the paint starts to fade. You don't notice the paint fading. But if somebody comes to your house 20 years after you've painted it, they look at it and they think, damn, it's about that time you repainted, your paint's faded, but you've lived with it so you haven't really noticed it so much. So this led us, and from my reading in permaculture, it kind of led us down the path of looking at the value of trees in the landscape. And I'd read a lot of stuff on alley farming and the benefits of planting shelter belts for stock. We'd seen the landscape when it had the trees on it and the quality of the soil. We'd seen it when it was first cleared in the production. We'd seen it, you know, further down the track when it was starting to lose its fertility. And the trees were trying to grow back on the landscape. That's one of the beauties of a lot of the timber types in Queensland. When you clear them, they will try to grow back again. So the work that was going on was people were finding new ways to re-clear the regrowth, and it was chemically, mechanically, and then when we arrived there, they'd just come out with this U-Butte implement called a blade plow. And you could pull this through the soil with a bulldozer, and that was the end of the regrowth. It totally destroyed it. So we started saying, well, we've got these trees in place. It's just a matter of working with them and managing them around our production system. So we tried a number of different configurations. We did the total mechanical clearing. We did some blade ploughing with leaving a percentage of timber. First we left, I think, about 20%. Then we got a bit braver and left 50%. And then, not really knowing where this was all taking us, we got involved with a group called Resource Consulting Service, and they were running a school called Grazing for Profit. So out of that, we suddenly were exposed to all these tools that we could actually start to measure the result of what we were doing. We started to keep in 1995, we started to keep a grazing chart so we could actually monitor the yield of our individual paddocks on a monthly and a yearly basis. So 6 months into keeping these records, and I was about to ring up a bulldozing contractor to take some more timber off this area that where we'd left 50% of the regrowth, and we added up the yield figures, and the surprising thing was the country with the trees on it was out-yielding the country that we'd mechanically totally cleared. So that was a real kind of light bulb moment for us. And we've now got 20 years of yield data across the whole property for our grazing animals. And any of our country with trees on it is is out-yielding the country without trees, or if it's not out-yielding, it's matching the yield. So we were then able to sit down and do the economic sums and see where it was, where the clearing had got us to, and the yield on the Brigalow soils was marginally more than it was on where we hadn't cleared. The yield on the vine thicket soils was actually less where we'd cleared than it was where we hadn't cleared. So we crunched the numbers, what it cost us to clear it, and we came up with a formula that said that at the end of the day, it was going to take us only 98 years to recoup the cost of re-clearing. So, yeah, we've become pretty passionate about having the trees there, and I go to lots of workshops and seminars, and generally the only thing we hear about trees is the massive amount of water that they transpire into the atmosphere every day. And we warn that, you know, we don't want to have too many trees. They'll be transpiring all this moisture out of the soil or out of the rivers back into the atmosphere. And we never told anything about how much trees in the landscape can reduce surface evaporation. My reading before coming back to Theodore, in some of the permaculture reading, was telling me that surface evaporation can be reduced by up to 70% by having trees in the landscape, by having shelter belts.
Can I just interrupt there and just want to clarify my point, Shane? What you're saying is farmers have been in the past taught to clear trees because they take the moisture out of the soil, and what you found that you're getting up to 70% more moisture in the soil or retained in the area because you've left the trees. Is that how I'm supposed to have heard you?
Well, it's reducing surface evaporation. So if you look at the environment we're working in, the annual surface evaporation is pretty close to 2 metres. And the annual rainfall is 0.7 of a metre. So if you look at those two figures alone and say, well, how can we influence? We've got more surface evaporation than we've actually got rainfall. So if we were to work in one area or the other, we cannot increase the rainfall. But gee, if we get in that evaporation, that 2 metres of evaporation, and we can reduce that by, you know, 50%, 30%, whatever, we can make great gains. So the information I was reading was that you can actually reduce surface evaporation by up to 70% by having trees in the landscape. And that 70% of 2 metres is a lot of water.
Yeah.
The other information that I came across more recently, and the guy's name escapes me at the moment, but he went to the fridge and pulled out a can of cold beer and sat it on the table in front of us. And we watched it while the moisture condensed on the outside of the can. And he explained to us that exactly the same thing happens when you've got trees in your landscape. They're a medium for condensation of moisture. So they attract moisture the same way as a can of cold beer does. So this made a lot of sense to me because we'd already done a lot of trials on our property through the Landcare movement and with Meat and Livestock Australia. And we established that where we had trees, our maximum temperatures were reduced by 5 degrees, and our minimum temperatures, the temperature was increased by 5 degrees. So it was obvious from that we were getting a cooling effect in the landscape associated with the trees. So it didn't take much for me to believe that there was a level of condensation happening. So there was, the trees were attracting moisture into the landscape. So when you connect this condensation with the reduction in evaporation, it all looks pretty damn good. And I kind of ignore the transpiration thing, and any moisture the trees are transpiring, I say, is going up into the atmosphere to form clouds to bring us more rain anyhow.
Yep. When you're talking about trees, in another report that you had previous to this one, excuse me, you gave the statistics on the Brigalow pasture come tree area to that of the eucalypts. Can you talk about that? Because we didn't cover that in the DVD that we sent out to our, our Farming Secrets members.
I'm not quite on the same page with you there, Hugo,
Brigalow, the pasture, the way you record your pasture, pasture growth, you found it's considerably higher in the Brigalow country than what it was in the eucalyptus country, where the eucalyptus trees grow.
Yeah, and that's a soil thing and a pasture species thing.
As well as the Brigalow. It's not necessarily the Brigalow trees.
Yeah, it's the soils that the Brigalow or the vine thicket grew on that were way better soils. They were clay-based soils, so they hold a lot more nutrient, water, and the eucalypt country is generally tends to be lighter, sandy soils, poorer soils that the moisture goes through. But the interesting thing that we've found over time is on that eucalypt country, with it's pretty much got all its timber intact. It's never been cleared. So the whole ecosystem is still alive and well. And with grazing management, we've been able to lift the yield off that eucalypt country. And I figure if we'd kept working with it, we could have probably got the yield off the eucalypt country up to where it was matching the off the Brigalow and the vine thicket country. All the different land types have their different attributes, and one of the real benefits of the eucalypt country in the landscape we worked in, it is warm country in the winter, so it tends to maintain a green pasture a lot longer. And the cattle move into it, they prefer to go into that country in the wintertime. They'll leave the more open, cleared scrub country. And a lot of the open, cleared scrub country tends to frost, so the quality of the feed goes off there a lot more.
Yeah. So it's a very good, it's a very good lesson because after the droughts in New South, especially in New South Wales, had a lot of regrowth, which was causing a lot of concern to the farmers there. And what you have explained in the first part of this conversation, that it's really made no difference.
Yeah, well, one of the major things that comes into this whole equation is to do with nutrient cycling. When we clear the trees off the landscape, we're removing the plants that are deep rooted, that are bringing nutrients up from deep down in the soil profile and bringing it back to the top where the grass can access it. So it's pretty easy to work out why the tree science in Queensland tells us that once we clear the trees, we'll get much better production from the grass. And the unfortunate thing that when they did the science, they missed out only two things. One was they didn't change the grazing system. It was basically all done under continuous grazing situations. And they didn't keep the experiment going for long enough to figure out that they'd totally broken the nutrient cycle by clearing the trees off. So all the measurements were done while the grasses were still exploiting the build-up of fertility from the trees. And they didn't keep the experiments going until after the nutrients had run out. And suddenly we were in the situation where we were when we came back to Theodore, where everybody was looking for the miracle pastures, pasture legumes, mechanical interventions, chemical fertilizers, you name it, to fix the problems that have been created.
And when you did your grazing for profit course, what happened on the properties, and what are the steps you've taken place, and what's been the advantage of the steps you have taken in place with your grazing and your grass? And fertility and soil, link it all together, if you like.
When I did the grazing for profit school, we'd been there for 10 years, and I was searching for, you know, what was the best options, and we tried everything. We tried the conventional, we tried the unconventional, and my accountant said to me, if you keep going the way you're going, you'll have to leave the country and join Christopher Scaife in Majorca. So I saw an ad in the Country Life for this grazing for profit school, and I thought, well, that's where my accountant would like me to go to. He'd like to see me making a profit. So away we went, and I'd already seen a cell grazing operation, a so-called cell grazing operation that failed, and so I was not at all interested in the grazing section of the grazing for profit workshop. I was only interested in all the stuff relating to how to run a business. So when they came to the grazing section, I already knew that it didn't work, but I listened to it, went through it, came home, and I figured that somehow or other they'd whet my appetite. So I thought, I'll give this stuff a bit of a try. So came home, and we'd been running a rotational resting type grazing operation with small mobs of about 60 to 100 breeders in each mob. And, you know, we might be sitting in a paddock for 2 or 3 months and letting one rest for the same time and then move them. So it was, you know, one mob of cattle probably to 2 paddocks. And so we amalgamated all our mobs, all our breeders into one mob. I think we had about 600 cows and calves in one mob. And we proceeded to rotate them around what paddocks we had. I proceeded then to build more electric fences, and I guess it was all good from there. Like it was the beginning of an addiction. I guess we could see the positive results of resting the country, of having a bigger mob of cattle going through smaller paddocks, and we just kept at it from middle of '93 until end of 96, and then we launched into a massive fencing program, which took us from about 25 paddocks up to about 60 paddocks, and that really gave us enough paddocks to start to get some horsepower into the operation. Subsequently, we've kept subdividing some of those paddocks. And I'll note that the subdivision that we did was all based on a plan that we did that worked it out in a cost per beast area to do the subdivision. So the more productive country was where we did most of the subdivision, because we could get an increase in production at less cost per beast area. And then the more expensive country to subdivide, that was what came, you know, later. And I think the latest stuff it was only about 2 years ago. And it was still not viable for us to fence it because of the low returns, but we were able to get funding from the Catchment Authority. to do that, which made it an attractive, so we could get it subdivided at virtually no cost and start the improvement of the pastures program there. But it's, you know, I guess the driver of the grazing system, other than rest, adequate rest for the pastures, the big driver is the number of animals you can put on a hectare. It's stock density. So you get briefly, the effect you get is they either eat it or they knock it down, and then you move them on. And what's knocked down then mulches into the soil, and the whole grass plant renews itself. So you come back the next time and you've got better quality pasture. So it's a really, I call our cows tractors. It's a really cheap way to improve the whole soil and pasture structure.
So talking on that same thing that we were just talking about now, in the DVD that we produced, you made mention that you could or did or have or will come out of a drought in a better shape than what your farm went into the drought. Can you explain that, or what sort of like what steps you put into place to actually to achieve that?
Yeah, and that's a kind of a far-fetched sort of a goal to set, but by then I was quite prepared to set myself pretty unrealistic goals. Coming back from the grazing for profit school in the middle of 93, we were fully stocked. We were actually overstocked. We'd built up our numbers to the number of breeders we wanted, and they all had calves. And we'd been looking for several months over the horizon waiting for rain to come because we were getting into low rainfall. And I was hanging on because we'd set this goal to have so many breeders and to be able to grow their progeny out to Jap Ops. So on arrival back from the grazing for profit, I got on the phone. I made two phone calls. One was to our stock and property agent, the other one was to the trucking company. And in a matter of a couple of weeks, we'd reduced our numbers down from, I think we had about 600 or 700 cows and calves, we reduced our numbers down to about 250 animal units. So all the calves went in trucks and the majority of the cows went. And this started the process, one of me having to convince my wife Shan that to sell cattle was a good idea. She had a tendency to get emotionally attached to the animals. So we did that, and the process went on then for 3 years. We would grow some grass, we'd buy some cattle. The grass would get down to a level where we saw that it was taking it backwards, and we would sell the cattle and wait until we'd grown grass, and we'd buy more cattle in. So over that 3 year period, all the cattle we sold had not reached market specifications. They had gained some weight. So again, I didn't know where this was taking us. We then took 3 years of financial figures and we fed them into a program that Resource Consulting Service had put together called Profit Probe. And the light bulb thing out of that was, even though we hadn't finished any cattle to market specs, our profitability was up purely through turnover. We had churned a hell of a lot of cattle over those 3 years of pretty ordinary rainfall. And in the process, we'd not only protected our pastures, but we'd left them in better condition. So as the minute we started getting rain, our grass was growing. And so it's kind of, we've developed it, I guess, into a bit of an art form. And again, it's it's all about what is your focus as a grazier. Is it the animals? Is it reaching market specs and having a bullock that's worth so many dollars or weighs so many kilos? Or is the focus on the soil and the pasture? And our focus was very firmly on the soil and the pasture and the condition and the animals, the kilos of animals that we were turning off was only a byproduct of what our landscape was like. And so if we could protect the soil and the pasture and get the animals off before they damaged them, then the bottom line of that was we could actually turn over more kilos of beef through that time. And when we got to the end of the drought, our landscape wasn't in really sorry condition. And as soon as we got rain, the landscape responded. And the response after drought has just got better every time we've had a drought. So I look on drought now as a wonderful tool to actually improve your whole landscape. It'll shift the composition of your, you can use it to shift the composition of your pasture. It's a wonderful tool to work with. Although, you know, we'd all love it to rain regularly every week or every month. The reality of living in Australia is it doesn't do that. So we have to gear our agricultural systems to where we become like a kangaroo that, you know, we can regulate our production according to what the season's going to do.
The one point that people in your area or in New South Wales have said that the farmers who look after their pastures like you did, they had very quick recovery when the drought breaks. Did you compare your property to neighbouring properties or properties within that area to see how they performed, the ones who wouldn't have used your system of looking after the soil and the grasses?
We try very hard not to compare ourselves with our neighbour. We tend more to compare ourselves with what's happening on the roadside. The roadside is often a pretty much untouched, unmodified landscape, and it's not subjected to any human management, like mechanical, chemical grazing management. And I steer clear of comparing myself with the neighbour for two reasons. One, it's a potential thing that can build up an animosity between people. The other thing is that if you compare yourself with a lower level of landscape health, then you've got nothing to strive for. You know, you already think, oh, I'm ahead of that, I don't need to do anything. So I try to look probably more at landscapes that are in better condition and compare to that. And I guess that if I can get the same recovery or better recovery in my pastures than is happening on the roadside, then I reckon that my system is starting to really cook and go somewhere. And we've got to the point now on the place of Theodore that after the worst droughts, and like our worst drought there in a 700 mil rainfall was one year, I think we got 225 mils or something for the year. And when we got the break, within 3 weeks, we have got a fully recovered pasture. Like we've got a full profile of feed within 3 weeks. And to make that kind of relevant, I guess, to our new property at Kilkeven, we had a break in the season here in March, and we kept the stock off this property until the 16th of June. So April, May, June, we basically, after that break in March, we had 3 or 3.5 months of rest on the country. The pastures, the property hasn't had grazing management before, so the property grew a full profile of grass. The rest of the district around here, where they didn't rest, basically, the land is in the same condition now as it was when we had that break in the season in March. So it's all chewed into the ground. So yeah, there's great benefit. Just the recovery is so quick, and if you can get that rest into it after a break in the season, it just helps the process so much more.
Right. Shane, we will open the line, so I'll just talk to farmers. Excuse me. So with farmers, when you're on just interrupt us and we'll just accommodate your questions. So just feel free to ask a question. So Shane, we'll be back to you, Shane. Do you want to keep talking about what you do on the farm or?
Yep, I can keep going. I've kind of got a list of, I guess, the things that are important. And, you know, as I started off with the soil and having soil in best possible condition, we're all dirt farmers. You know, we've got to look after the soil and get it into the best possible condition. And one of the greatest tools we got to do this is plants. So ultimately, if we can have green and growing plants on our soils for 12 months of the year, they through their photosynthesis process are pumping sugars into the soil that feeds the life in the soil. Plants are important, and if you can get photosynthesis, so in the landscape we're in here at Kilkeven, it's dominated by summer active pastures. So now that we've had frosts in the last few weeks, everything's frosted off. There's very, very, very little winter active pasture. So our whole photosynthesis program here has come to a screening halt. So one of my priorities in this landscape is to establish more winter active species. We had the same issue to a degree at Theodore, but we didn't get as much frosting there, so a lot of our summer actives would stay green right through the winter period. But in that landscape, any of the winter active species tend to get eliminated by grazing animals because it's that time of the year when the most pressure comes on the pastures from grazing animals. So yeah, it suffered as well from a lack of winter active species. The other thing to me that is really paramount is to do with water, and it's to do with infiltration when you get rainfall. And it's been documented in West Australia that where you've got perennial grasses, you get far superior rainfall infiltration to what you do with bare ground or litter-covered ground. And the difference is, like on bare ground, it's something like 25 millimetres per hour. Where you've got a perennial grass plant, your infiltration is 175 millimetres per hour. So 150 mils difference in per hour of infiltration from rain. And then in that trial, they did a second rainfall simulation. The infiltration on the bare ground, it actually halved. Dropped down to 12 mils per hour. On the perennial grass plant, the infiltration rate actually increased went up to 300 millimetres. So it went from 175 mils up to 300 mils. Now, this sort of information to me, where I see in our agricultural, in our Australian landscape, the single most limiting factor is rainfall, is moisture availability. So if we can increase our infiltration rates and then have it increase again on a second rainfall event by having perennial pastures, then we've, in a way, we're achieving the best we can. And the next thing that goes with this rainfall infiltration and is actually the water holding capacity of the soil. So a soil with 100 kilograms of soil with 1.5 to 2% organic matter will hold 45 litres of water. The same soil with, I think it's 4 to 5% organic matter, will hold 200 litres of water.
Huge difference.
So almost four times as much water just by having a couple more percent of organic matter in the soil. I look at what's happening, you know, people talk about global warming and climate change, and some people talk about we're going into another ice age, and so there's a whole lot of debate out there about our rainfall and our climate. And I look at the weather events that are happening now all over the planet, and we have these incredible dumps of rain, like massive big rainfall events. And then we seem to go into long periods of nothing. Here at Kilkeven, we've had 160 millimetres in March. Since March, I'm looking in my rainfall records that I've got right in front of me here, and since March, we've had 17 millimetres in April, 37 in May, 8 in June, and so far for July we've had 2. So we just seem to go into these really low rainfall, long periods of low rainfall, and then all of a sudden you'll get another big dump. So the importance of getting good infiltration rates, of having good water holding capacity is just getting more and more important to be able to capture those rainfall events, the big dumps. And the other thing we can achieve by doing this, getting a landscape like this, we can actually reduce the flooding in the cities. Brisbane, Gympie, Maribyrnong, Bundaberg, that have all had massive floods. If we were keeping that rainfall back on our farms, back in the catchment, they wouldn't be having the floods they're getting. The reason that they're getting those massive floods is because our landscape is in a condition where it cannot, the rainfall can't infiltrate, and what does, the landscape can't hold it. In 1969, all the creeks and rivers around Theodore stopped flowing. First time ever the Dawson River had stopped flowing. The creeks, the sandy creeks around there, have not flowed since then. They have not flowed since 1969. When I was a kid, they used to flow. They had water holes. You go fishing as a kid down the creeks. No more. There's no water holes. They only flash flood, and then they dry up again. This is a direct result of us clearing the landscape of trees, of poor grazing management, poor cropping management. We've reduced the infiltration, so when we get rain, the water runs off the surface, flash floods, goes and floods another town downstream somewhere, and we get bigger droughts. So, yeah, the water is so important, management of our rainfall and being able to keep it on the farm. And this was the stuff that some of the stuff that P.A. Yeomans was on about years and years ago.
Now, you also mentioned that a lot of the, I think it's you who mentioned it, that a lot of Australia's rainfall is a waste because it's less than 15 mils, and 15 mils is what's, anything under 15 mils doesn't have any benefit. Did you say that?
Yeah, that was when we were at Theodore and we were getting a little bit of rain and growing some grass and, you know, you go to town or talk to the neighbours and people will tell you, we only had 2 or 3 mils or so many mils and pretty useless rain. It's not enough to grow any grass. So I sat down and analysed, I think it was 3 years of rainfall and 70% of our rainfall events actually fitted into what people were calling useless rainfall events. So I looked at that and I thought, well, we really need to get our landscape in a condition that we can grow grass on 0.5 millimetre of rain, on a heavy dew. We need to start to be able to work with those so-called useless rainfall events that were 70% of the rainfall that we were getting. I'm I'm pretty passionate about using what moisture's there. And, you know, like in this environment where we are at Kilkeelan, we get a lot of heavy dews and fog in the morning, and I think this farm we're on used to be a very productive dairy farm in the past. And I think that those fogs and dews may have been one of the drivers that made this landscape so productive in the past.
Yeah. You do mention, you mentioned a fair bit of time about, or put a fair bit of emphasis on anti-fragile. Can you sort of give us a bit of a talk about what you mean by anti-fragile and how that relates to farming?
This was a book that I came across written by a guy in the States, and it's titled Anti-Fragile, and then the subtitle is Things That Benefit From Disorder. And I read it and it made a lot of sense to me, and it comes back to things like our setting our goal to have our land in better condition after a drought than it was going into the drought. So it's setting your systems up so that they actually benefit from disorder. If we get a flood, drought or fire, that we can actually benefit from it rather than being a victim and coming out kind of licking our wounds, complaining about how hard done by we are. We need to start looking at our systems and saying, how can we actually benefit from this? How can we benefit from having a fire? How can we benefit from a flood or the unusual dumps of rainfall or the droughts? How can we benefit from these things and help them to shift our, not only our landscape forward, but shift our businesses forward and you know, the people that are working in these environments, the people in agriculture, so often you see people in the drought, they've got increased workload because they're feeding stock, they're pumping water, and, you know, at the end of the drought, they're totally buggered. You know, they're worn out, they're physically and mentally and emotionally tired. So I look at a drought now and say, wow, what an opportunity. I can reduce my stock numbers so I've got less stock to look after, less stock to manage, and that creates more time for me to go to the beach. And it's one of the beauties of this is if you've got, the era of the mobile phone, you can be sitting on the beach relaxing and your bank manager rings you to see how you're going and he thinks you're at home working. So that's one of the great benefits of mobile communications.
Yeah.
But, you know, we personally come out of droughts now where we're in much better shape, like physically, mentally, emotionally. We're in better shape at the end of the drought than we were going into it because we've had time off. We've had less stock to manage.
Well, I hope farmers can hear what you had to say and take that seriously, because that if farmers can hear what you just said and take it seriously, it would be a huge turning point in the way they farm, or many way, because a lot of Australia is regarded as as a country of the most unpredictable rains, and we have these times when things don't go to plan. So as pastures go, or grass grows, or even crops.
I think Hugo, that's part of our evolution. That's why we've all ended up in Australia. I think the master plan wants us to learn how to manage climate variability. We've got to learn to become like the native wildlife and vegetation that's learnt to live with this massive variability in climate. And it actually, you know, they thrive, don't they? You look at the kangaroos and the eucalypt trees and the brigalow trees. They thrive in this environment. They've learnt the art of anti-fragile, and I think it's a great concept. It's kind of like, you know, if you get hit with something big, then how can you benefit from it? How can you come out of it smelling like a rose?
Yeah, that's great statement. That's good. We haven't got much time left, but can you give us a bit of a rundown of why you took on biodynamics and this for the Theodore property, and maybe even tell us if the biodynamics has kicked in on the Kilkeven property? Why did you take it on, and is there any benefits of using biodynamics on Theodore?
I first came across biodynamics in the early 70s when I was in the permaculture group, and read the book, put it back in the bookshelf, and it collected dust until 2002. And I suddenly, biodynamics came onto my radar again, and I was well ready for it. I already kind of knew what was behind it, so it was no big thing to embrace it. And we started to use it, and I started to see massive changes in the soil and the pasture as a result of using biodynamics. It appealed to me because I can make all the products myself with materials within my own farm, so it doesn't cost anything except a bit of time. It's moved up the order of priorities to where the Kilkeven property. The first thing we did was start putting out the biodynamic preparations, and now 6 months into being here, the whole farm has been treated three times. We're already seeing big changes in the soil. Work I've done at an intensive level with a leasing farmer at Theodore, in 5.5 months, we changed his river flats from something pretty similar to concrete to a very nice dark friable loam, and his production figures went up. I think on a block that he was cutting 450 bales off, he is now cutting 700 bales off the same block. So it had a benefit in the soil. It had a benefit in production. Now, for our own properties at a grazing level, we can't measure like that because we're not as intensive. But I see the changes in the soils. Like when I first introduced the biodynamics, I'll take soil samples and put them in sandwich bags. And then over time, when I put the preparations out again, I'll take more soil samples, put them in sandwich bags, and then I can compare over time at no cost what changes happen in the soil. On this property, we've done soil tests through the environmental analysis lab at Lismore, Southern Cross University. And so I've got a benchmark soil test, and 12 months into the program on this new farm, we'll take soil tests again, as well as tissue tests, and and have a look at what the biodynamic preparations have done to change the soil. I'm anticipating we'll have a complete change in nutrient status. So it's, with that, it's a matter of watch this space. But it's, to me, it's moved up to where it's the first thing I do on a landscape now.
So biodynamics gets all sorts of terminologies gets used on biodynamics in a derogatory way. And to me, that's because very few people can make, can't make, or very few input providers, well, they can't make money out of the farmer. But so how do you, can you give sort of, give us a bit more rundown on the biodynamics, how you use it and how you feel about it and whether it's for other farmers as well? In other words, I think it should be brought into, every farmer should use it. And that's why I want you to sort of expand a bit on biodynamics.
Okay, just, yeah, look, briefly, if you look at all our landscapes before we were here, they all function. A lot of our methodologies have shut down a lot of those functions, be it clearing, ploughing, putting on chemicals, herbicides, insecticides. We've shut down a lot of that natural function. The biodynamic preparations, pretty much in my picture of it, is when we start using them, we start to reinstate that natural functioning of the landscape. So that's the simplest way for me to explain it. And you know, the other thing I said before, it's cheap. You can make the stuff yourself, so you can actually be in control of your own destiny without having to go to town and buy inputs. And I think that's one of the major barriers with biodynamics is we're so used to putting on tons of this and tons of that and seeing an instant result. When we apply biodynamics, I'm putting out 150 grams of product per hectare. 150 grams of product per hectare. So it seems like we're doing nothing. And I know myself, you're sort of sitting on your tractor or whatever you're putting the stuff out with and you're thinking, oh, this can't possibly work. You know, like when your mindset is in tons per hectare.
Yeah. Now, would you say that you can see results in the condition of your cattle and the condition of your grass? And well, you mentioned the soil has improved by using biodynamics. So what's the condition of the grass and your cattle when it comes to your assessment of using biodynamics?
One of the common things of when you start putting out biodynamic preparations, it lifts the palatability of pastures. So you hear lots of people saying, oh, I sprayed half of the paddock and that's the only half the cattle will go on. So in terms of, yeah, palatability of pastures, we've seen big increases in palatability. Some species that the stock wouldn't eat, they started using. And look, any change in soil, any improvement in soil health and pasture health naturally comes forward in you know, better animal performance and animal health.
And have you seen that in the animal health?
Yeah.
Good. And what about the buyers? Are they happy with the animals?
The buyers, well, yeah, we most of what we sell goes to meatworks, and so we've never had the meatworks ring us up and say, oh, we don't want any more of those stock, they're rubbish.
Okay. Shane, no good. I actually have heard from Hamish Mackay that I think it was your property that the meatworks said that you know, send us some more for your animals. We like them. So there you are.
But we've had buyers come in to buy store cattle from us in the yard, and they're absolutely amazed at how placid the animals are and how easy they are to work around.
Yeah, and they know what they're looking at too, those buyers. Shane, we've come to the time that we should wind this up. So I'd like to thank all the people who are online and the people who will be listening to this CD. thanks to the Farming Secrets members. And Shane, most importantly, want to thank you because you're the one who's made this conversation what it has been. So well, have you got a parting note that you want to finish up on, Shane?
Yeah, look, here you go, thanks. And yeah, look, all credit to yourself and Helen for putting this sort of a thing together. That's so valuable to get these messages out to the general public. So thank you.
No, look, I really appreciate you coming online. Shane, so thank you very much. I'm going to say goodbye, so it's goodbye from me. And Shane, would you like to say goodbye?
Yep, goodbye from me as well.
Thank you very much, Shane. Bye-bye to the family. Bye-bye.